The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 50. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 50, introduced by Representative Gingrey, an act related to taxation and revenue, tax sales costs. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, who respectfully returned it with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, excused, Goggles, and Wallace, signed Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard of the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 50 do pass. There are no amendments at this time, and I would turn the explanation of the bill over to Representative Gingrey.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to me by the Association of Treasurers for our state. There is a piece of paper on your desk somewhere, piled in all the other papers that are on your desk. At the top it says Teton County Treasurer. She was writing this on behalf of the County Treasurers Association, and explains their reasoning for wanting this bill passed. What this deals with is when you don't pay your taxes, they actually come take stuff from you, whether that's your real property or personal property. So you'll see this twice in the bill. The first example is personal property. In the word distraint, if you see there, it means seizure and sale of personal property. And then the other one is real property. In both situations, they're going to sell that property in order to recover back the amount owed on your taxes. They're allowed to charge for their cost, the cost that went into seizing your property and selling your property. There's two costs being talked about here. One is the legal advertising, and the law right now says you can pay up to $20. The difficulty is that the treasurers took a poll of themselves, and most of them are paying somewhere between $30 and $40 for the advertising advertising of these sales. You've probably seen them in the paper. It's like a long list of all the different sale property in case you wanted to come and bid on it. The difficulty is though, so then the treasurer is actually having to pay for this out of the general fund of that county rather than having the person who is buying the property pay the cost of the advertising. So all they're wanting to do is go from $20 up to a maximum of $40. It doesn't mean they actually charge the $40. They can go up to $40 on the advertising. The second part is more of just a cleanup. It changes the mileage from 23 cents, which is listed in the statute, and updates it to how we do it on all of our other statutes. If you look through other statutes that pay for mileage, such as ourselves, we don't actually state an actual mileage amount because it changes on a yearly basis. So what the statute actually does there on page 2, it says the mileage shall be equal to the amount computed pursuant to 9-3-103. How that works is, if you look up Title IX, is it is set by the executive branch through a formula. And so every year it can be adjusted without having to come back to the legislature and get us to change every year the mileage rate. Most of our statutes read that way, that the mileage is computed pursuant to Title IX. For whatever reason, this was never updated, and it's still back at the 23 cents. I think we're actually at 55 cents. So that just updates that. My understanding from the treasurers, it's very rarely used. They actually don't travel much to the sales site, so it's not an incredibly used one. It's the advertising one that they were concerned about. That's the whole explanation of the bill. I'd stand for any questions.
Any further discussion on the bill? The question having been called, all those in favor of Representative Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 50 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 50 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 22. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 22, introduced by Representative Illaway, an act relating to the Veterans Property Tax Exemption. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which respectfully reported back with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlach. Excused, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 22 do pass. And I'd also like to move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 at this time. And what that does and explain it does is change the date from enactment date from July back to January 1st of this year, so that it'll work with the county treasurers. And I would call for the question on the amendment.
Okay, the question having been called on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Commitment Number 1 is passed Committee of the Whole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now I'd like to turn the explanation of the bill over to Representative Illaway, and I presume he'll do as good a job as the last bill was explained, and we'll get on with the business.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Qualification for veterans tax exemption. The crux of the entire bill is on page 2. One of the reasons I brought this bill is because under the proposed rules from the Wyoming Department of Revenue, one of the rules says is an applicant must sign exemption claim form in the presence of the county assessor or other authorized employee. And it also says the county assessor can accept a notarized signed claim form. Some of these veterans don't get out of their house. Some of these veterans are extremely old. What we have put here is to say, after filing a sworn claim pursuant to subsection C of this section, in subsequent years, the claimant may qualify for the tax exemption provided by this section by contacting the assessor's office by telephone or other communication method on or before the fourth Monday in May and verifying that the veteran continues to meet the requirements set forth in this section. Now, that's when I read that, on or before the fourth Monday in May, that is one reason that we put the amendment in to be January 1, so that the assessors can be sending this out and those folks can pick up the telephone and communicate with the assessor. We heard testimony from one assessor that they verify that by using the obituaries in the newspaper. Many counties, we heard, do put the exemption on back of the schedule. But to expect a veteran to have to sign an exemption claim form every year or to sign a notarized form is probably more than we would want them to do. They served the country, and once they've claimed it, that should be good enough, except that every year they have to call the assessor and say, I'm still alive. Other than that, I will stand for any questions.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly rise in support of this legislation. It's being brought by the good representative from Laramie County. When I signed on to this bill, it's certainly something that we needed to go forward with. I'm a veteran of foreign wars and work with the Veterans of Foreign Wars organizations. We have numerous veterans. They're incapacitated and cannot get around very well, specifically talking to those of the World War II vintage up to the current status that we have in Afghanistan and Iraq. One of the concerns we had in the committee, and is already addressed, is possibly a fraud being perpetrated here by someone that is not qualified for this or upon the passage of a veteran. I think we pretty well exhausted that. The assessor felt comfortable with it. I know I certainly do, and the veterans I've worked with and the way we're going over in Yuna County. So I certainly urge the body to support this legislation.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the bill, but I just have a question in terms of other property tax relief and the applications for qualification. I think this is not the only bill with this type of mechanism in it that once you file it, you're eligible. But the veterans exemption has no other eligibility requirements other than that the person served in the applicable, or it has, tell me what the others are, what the other qualifications other than service.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are dates where these fellows have served in various conflicts, although I do understand that there's a bill making its way, I think, on the other side in regards to changing some of those dates. But we do have dates dating back past World War II, I guess, in the statute.
Any more discussion on the bill? Okay, the question is, question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 22 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 22 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 102. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 102, introduced by the Revenue Committee, an act relating to taxation and revenue, excise tax, vendor compensation. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which reported back a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace, signed Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 102 do pass. And I'd also like to move the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 at this time and ask for your vote on that. It changes the date, effective date, from July 09 to January 1st, 2010. This was at the request of the Revenue Department to get the necessary rules and paperwork and all that in effect and go in on the calendar year. If there's no objection to that, I'd call for the question.
The question having been called on Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 102, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill, or Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 102 is passed Committee of the Whole.
I'm wondering if that no vote would like to change their vote at this time. However, this bill is vendor compensation. It's been presented to the legislature numerous times. If I remember my history right, our senior senator, when he was a House member, got this bill passed through the House, and it didn't make it through the Senate, but we've seen it before. What this bill does is, and you do have a piece of paper on your desk that's been passed out, that will tell you some of the things that, positive things about this vendor compensation. What the bill calls for is for every person who is collecting sales tax for the state of Wyoming is entitled to keep 1% of that tax collected for the administrative costs, up to $10,000 in a year's time. So your many of your retailers, vendors, will be able to get 1% of their total. However, your big box stores will reach that maximum probably in the first week of the operation in the year and not go any further. We did look at some other avenues. We looked at 2% with a limit of 5,000. We looked at 3% with a limit of 3,500, I think, and they all were more expensive to the state than this, and it didn't look like the feeling of the committee was that we ought to start slow on this and see how it works. What precipitated this to begin with is, and the streamlined sales tax national issue is obligated before they get by the bills that are in Congress right now to pay vendor compensation. And our feeling in the committee was that if we're going to pay vendors in Nebraska and Utah to collect sales tax for the state of Wyoming, why shouldn't we compensate our own vendors somewhat? The Price Waterhouse study on this thing indicated that the administrative costs run from 3% to 13% for the collection of sales tax. Now those high ones are probably in states like Colorado where you gotta collect sales tax for a county, for the state, for the city, for something else, and then send them all to different avenues. But this, it would seem that it doesn't come very, it doesn't overcompensate, but that the 1% is a start on paying our vendors to collect tax for the state of Wyoming. You can look at the fiscal note if you'd like, and that's what the it is estimated that it would cost to be that much decrease in revenues from sales tax throughout the state. Any questions? Be glad to answer or try to answer at least.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to declare a conflict on this bill.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask the good sponsor of this, chairman of this legislation, what all taxes constitute an excise tax?
It's your sales tax. If you're collecting 5-6%, that's the one we're talking about. If you have a sales tax license, you'll be compensated for the amount, and it'll be just on the form that you send in for your sales tax report, deduct this much, and then there will be some complications when you reach the $10,000 figure, but the department says that they can handle that. I think there's an administrative cost of something on this thing, too.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you for the follow-up, Mr. Chairman. We were talking about taxes this morning on tobacco, and I thought that was being referred to as an excise tax as well. So that's what was kind of confusing me, whether this was just for those collectors of sales tax or whether there was other kind of taxes that would also apply.
Chairman Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of this, that they still would collect the sales tax that comes off on those products, but not the per unit tax. That goes on kind of with a license, much like the cigarette tax.
Representative Gilmore.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to declare a conflict. I didn't realize my first chance at the speaker would be that quick.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just maybe a question and then a couple of comments. The first question is how often is it monthly or quarterly that businesses have to turn in sales tax? That's number one. And then just a few comments that, you know, I first look at this and I kind of like the idea, but then the more I look at it, I'm not so sure. You know, the businesses receive a lot of benefits in the way of, I'm sure, fire protection, police protection, streets, things like that, from their local governments that are funded in large part by sales and use taxes. And then the other issue I have is, you know, in my business, it's a profession that we are not yet required to collect sales tax. However, we are required to do payroll taxes not only to the federal government but also to the state in the form of workers' compensation and in the form of unemployment insurance. And it takes a great deal of my time every quarter to go do that. I got to do the calculations of all the wages, the excess wages, multiply it out, and figure out how much I have to send a check to the state for. And so I'm not sure where this would stop, and I'm also not sure if it would be equitable to those other businesses, because why not give a credit for us figuring out what workers' comp is and unemployment taxes too? I just don't know how you draw the line so nicely and cleanly with sales tax.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you. I'd like to answer that. We just did draw it nice and cleanly as far as that goes if this bill passes. This is not unknown. Those taxes that are collected for cigarette tax, they collect the compensation for putting those whatever the little seals go on those cigarette packages. There is a revenue that they are able to deduct from that when they pay that tax, and so it's not unknown. There's about 39 states already allow this, I think that, well, make any difference what I think, it's what you think.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You know, while I understand the plight of small business people, particularly retailers, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical of the overall consequences, similar to the majority floor leader. The esteemed chairman mentioned that this is a good start, and that's kind of my fear. Should retailers be compensated for any of the following, or frankly, people that aren't even in the retail business, for example, federal unemployment tax, federal withholding tax, FICA, workers' comp tax, state unemployment tax, mineral severance tax, industrial property taxes, who should be compensated as a business person for managing the cost of those collections? The discussion on the large store, small store, if we set the value of the collection at 1% and capped at $10,000, how soon will it be before somebody comes in and says, wait a minute, you're being just a little bit more or less than fair? You know, I don't know a whole lot about retailer, and I heard a little bit about the collection of tobacco taxes and having to put the stamps on the packs and those kinds of things, but and this is certainly no social comment, but they are exposed to secondhand smoke. That's a pun. But again, Mr. Chairman, I just realize that there probably is some unfairness in this, or if at least not now, potentially there could and could be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've never known anyone that didn't want less taxes, and in a way, this is a less tax for the small businesses, and generally I'm in favor of that. But I think we're challenged now, and we will be for a number of years going forward, to look at what happens when we reduce taxes to cities, towns, counties, and the state. And so when I look at the $3.2 million reduction in revenue through this process, I think of what other projects would we be not able to fund if this didn't happen. That said, I'll be looking at it on those bills that have expenditures and increases in budget. I'll be looking at those the same way. Is that a trade-off on other things? It's a fairly significant reduction in money. That $3.2 million, if I read it correctly, is something that we have to consider. So I would be cautious on this one, not because I'm in favor of continuing taxes that we have, but if we're paying for this service, or we're not paying for this service now, I hadn't heard other arguments that this was a burden, but it would be nice if people could get another $10,000 minimum. I can see the arguments for it, but I'm not sure in this environment this is the time for this bill. So I would urge caution as you decide to vote up or down on this bill.
Chairman Anderson.
I'd also just like to say that the way I read the rules as far as I guess I need to call for the privilege of the floor first on this.
Go ahead, Chairman Anderson.
Where I read the rules on this, if you have a sales tax license, it isn't necessarily a conflict of interest, because this is certainly a big class of people that are being affected here, and I would guess probably half the people here have held a sales tax license one time or another, and you're dealing with all those, not just one, and so I'm not sure that anyone needs to declare a conflict of interest on this. However, the bill, back on the bill. The bill is before us. It got pretty good review in the committee. I think that the small business are going to benefit the most from this for whatever they have to hire to get that tax work done. And so that's where we stand, and it's up to your vote.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't think I was going to speak on this, but it's obvious a lot of us haven't had retail businesses because it is very special and it's very difficult. My wife ran a restaurant for 11 years where I sat and enjoyed the smell of secondhand smoke and the sound of freedom. And during that time, I remember her working late nights to compute how much she owed you and then putting up with the audits that came through. And I wanted to work those boys over every time they came and used up hours of her time. I don't know, maybe more of you ought to get involved in business because it is difficult to collect the tax. And I realize some of us lawyers, like the good representative from Goshen County and I, lawyers are always fighting having to pay sales tax. You tried to impose it once or twice on us, and we fought like cats and dogs because we don't like to compute your tax. I think this is a good first step. I'd just soon we get down that road, and I remember when we used to do it, I always wondered, why do we have to collect money for you from these people that mumble and grumble about the price of their food? So I'm going to stand for this one. Thank you.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You also want to remember each of those people have already paid $60 for the privilege of collecting that tax. That's what the license costs. And so there is that factor in there as well. I'd urge your a positive vote on this.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the attorneys on the floor, it seems like they're never happy. They complain because they don't have sales tax, and they complain because they're not getting the exemptions. I mean, what are you going to do? Anyways. I come from a family who owns several small businesses, and collecting the tax is somewhat of a pain. Thank goodness there's programs out there that make it fairly simple. The state has moved to the website. You do it all wireless. It's very quick and very easy, but you still have to do it. This isn't anything new. You get a fee for having to collect for child support garnishments, or if they have other garnishments, you always get to take either a portion, a percentage, or a set amount of the fee. So this is just keeping in line with other costs of doing business. This is good for small business. It stimulates the economy. What helps our economy is not bigger government. What helps our economy is stimulated small businesses on and for the bill.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know with interest, for those of you that have been around long enough to understand the discussion on the sales tax on food and the lack of reimbursement, that the local governments have been less than appreciative over the past few years because that backfill has not been made permanent. I notice with interest here that we have a $6,100,000 figure, but yet there isn't an appropriation. Shall we just apply that $6,100,000 to our discussion on the sales tax on food and the lack of total backfill or reimbursement to the cities, towns, and counties of making that permanent as well.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've appreciated all the comments and especially those of the good representative from the land of the jackalope. But the point isn't whether or not we should allow businesses to have a refund. My point is that there are a lot of businesses that collect other than the sales tax, and I just don't think it's fair and equitable for those who spend a lot of time calculating all those other taxes who don't collect a sales tax, that's true, but they don't get the benefit of a refund for the taxes that they do collect. I think I'd be all for it if it was equitable across the board for all businesses, but it simply is not.
Chairman Anderson.
Several years ago, we tried to put sales tax on attorneys, and then if you'd be willing to do that, we could do it. Then it'd be further across the board.
Point of order. All right. Any other discussion on the bill? Okay, the question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 102 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
House Bill 102 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 9. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 9, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to subdivisions, cluster developments. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which respectfully reported back with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 9 do pass. And I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, which will be discussed as the good representative from District 43 goes through the bill.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will talk about the bill and then bring the Standing Committee Amendment for a vote. The Corporations Committee brings you this bill after 3 years of work and study. In the ongoing efforts to help the county commissioners of our state deal with land use issues and subdivisions, we are creating another tool for the toolbox called conservation design. Last year, this body passed regulations to allow counties to restrict subdivisions below certain thresholds. That's had varying success throughout our state. The inverse, especially for those counties that didn't adopt the new minimum acreage, is to allow this process that simultaneously allows cluster development and protects open space. Walking through the bill, it does affect Title 18, Chapter 5, sets up definitions where we're creating a process called conservation design. Basically, it must protect wildlife habitat and enhances and maintains the rural character of lands. The definition of cluster development will be a process that takes in the county conservation design process and has two-thirds of the total area of the parcel being divided at the time of the development for the further preservation of open space. In Section D, we're basically setting land aside for 99 years. I'll come back with a Standing Committee Amendment here in a second and talk about that. Basically, you can subdivide and develop part of the land as long as two-thirds of the greater land is held in a small perpetuity for open space. Then on page 4, we are defining density bonus, open space, residential units. The crux of the bill is 185403. The county commissioners have the option of doing this conservation design process. And basically, if they do approve these permits, the plat must be under the supervision of a professional land surveyor, and it must meet the requirements of retention and maintenance of the open space. It does go to the board. They have to provide that the conservation design requirements have been met, reasonable fee. Then 185404 goes into enforcement, back with the county. 185405 just does the basic notice to the state engineer, which we find in other statutes and subdivisions. And then 185303, we just put that exemption for cluster development into the statute. That's basically the bill. It allows for county oversight. It helps promote open space. It helps keep ag producers viable. We do have a standing committee amendment, if I could walk through that briefly. Basically what this does is several things. Every time in the bill that we've restricted 99 years, we're changing that to 65. A lot can happen in 65 years. That would be two generations of open space if this statute survives for 65 years, as it is. This was brought to us by one of the agricultural groups in our state and would help with land use planning, the 65-year number. We also are defining private recreation to not include trails or hiking trails. This is an event that if you are keeping this for open space, you can still have recreational trails on it as long as it's free from structures and impermeable surfaces. Page 6, line 6 just sets the process after 65 years that the current owners have the right of first refusal to acquire the land should they wish to sell it after that 65-year period. I would be happy to stand for any questions. You may, or actually, I would call for a vote on the Standing Committee Amendment at this time.
Any discussion on the amendment? The question having been called on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 9.
Mr. Chairman, point of order, please.
Mr. Speaker.
I would like to either have more discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment or divide it. So I'd move to divide the Standing Committee Amendment. The first division would be... page 1, lines 1 through 9.
Thank you.
Lines 14 through 17 to the period after the word insert. So division 1, lines 1 through 9, and lines 14 through line 17, and on line 17 through the word insert, close quote, period. And then the remainder of the amendment would be division 2.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Would the ruling be that that is divisible, Mr. Chairman?
It is divisible. So just to be clear, division 1 will be line 1 through 9 and line 14 through 17 where the period is after insert. And then the second division will be the remainder of the Standing Committee Amendment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good speaker didn't necessarily define his concerns, but I will try to go through these in more depth. Unless you'd like to at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to division number 1, if you would like to vote on that, if there is no further objection.
Okay, the question has been called on division 1 of Standing Committee number 1 to House Bill 9. All those in favor of that division signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Division 1 of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed Committee of the Whole. We're now on Division 2 of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. I had a question about Division 2. If you go to page 6, line 3 of the bill, it inserts... If the area of open space is owned in common by the owners of the lots, that refers to a term of art in property ownership. Ownership in common means that you own it as a divided share. You can also have joint tenancy, which most of us have with our spouses on property. Whether it's a vehicle or land, joint tenancy means you own an undivided one half and that the whole thing passes to the survivor upon death of the first to die. Tenancy in common means it's divided. So you can actually, under Wyoming law, divide property that's owned by tenants in common. If myself and my colleague from Cody own a piece of property together as tenants in common and we don't like what one of us doesn't like what the other's doing, he can file a petition to partition that land and divide it, actually. That's what common ownership is. So that's what it's referring to in that amendment as I read it to page 6, line 3. Then the second part of Division 2 to Standing Committee Amendment number 1, if ownership of the open space land, and this goes to page 6, line 6. If ownership of the open space land is retained by the permit applicant, the provision shall provide for a process whereby the owners of the lots shall have a right of first refusal to acquire the land preserved in open space prior to any development of the land following expiration of the initial 65-year period. I'm confused by the language in page 6, line 3, where it says that if the area of the open space is owned in common by the owners of the lots, that means they own it subject to some type of an easement or restrictive covenant on that parcel. But the second part of the amendment says that somebody else has a right of first refusal to acquire the land preserved in open space. But I guess there's a distinction. The first part of the second division is if the land is owned in common, that's one way. The second part of it says if ownership of the open space land is retained by the permit applicant. So I'm the applicant, and I developed this division, and I've got, just envision a square. And in the top left quarter of it, there are 12 lots. And then the rest of the three quarters of that square is open space. If I retain all the open space and the other 12 people own it, then they have the right to acquire the land in open space. But how do they, what is that right that they have? Can one lot owner acquire the whole thing? It leaves in its vagueness a lot of questions about how you exercise that right of first refusal to acquire the land preserved in open space after the 65-year period. And it's a fairly complicated question to write all that out as to how that can happen. Rights of first refusal are an encumbrance on property, because that means that you've given somebody a right to buy that property before you can sell it. The right of first refusal, does it have to be a bona fide offer? Does it really have to be a good offer, or it can just be somebody offered me $50,000 for that acre. There, I'm making you the offer. Is it in writing? What happens to it? And I'm not sure why that right of first refusal is in there, other than to protect those people who live in that corner from development of the rest of the open space. But after the 65-year period, or whatever it is, should they have a right to dictate what happens on the open space? That then raises the issue of, is the dedication, how do you dedicate it to open space? Do you do it through an easement? Why does the easement expire after 65 years? Why 99 years? If it's a restrictive covenant, can you allow that? So I'm just uncertain about whether that's the correct language. And then if again, I'm that permit holder and I've deeded it to my grandchildren, and it's 60 years later, and those lot owners up in the corner have changed ownership numerous times, who do I give notice to about their right of first refusal? And how long do I have to honor that? What happens after the 65-year period is done? Do I still have to give them notice? So I think that provision, it bothers me. So I'm on and against Division 2 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we did a lot of the work in this in committee, and I'll try to answer the questions as best I can. First, we have to understand what we're talking about with a clustered subdivision. I think we have all agreed, at least in our committee we all agreed, I don't think there's any dissension that we think the cookie-cutter subdivisions are wrong, where we're going to take 35-acre pieces or for any 35 or above, and we're just going to chop those up and we're going to put a house in the middle of each one of those cookie-cutter things. And there is a model that is presently being marketed in, it's either in Johnson or Campbell County, which is the evolution of several previous attempts to do that. One of them, a large ranch near Douglas, if you know about that. And And these were all attempts to do things a different way. In this different way, this particular developer, some of you know him well, said, I want to take a large ranch and I want to subdivide it, but I don't want to do this cookie cutter deal because it just makes a mess out of it. And it ends up with some people in the middle of the hay meadow, some people up on the hill. You've got all this stuff. There must be a better way. And the better way is this, that we set a ratio of open space to development, 35 acres per house. And we say, you don't have to put each house in each distinct or discrete, I think would be the word, 35-acre parcel. And in this particular development, as it's being done now, there is a ratio of one home per 35 acres, but they're situated in such a way that none of them can even see each other. They don't see each other's yard lights. They don't see each other's roads. They don't see anything. That is a method that we're trying to recognize statutorily. So we're saying there's a ratio. You have to have so much open space per residence, but you don't necessarily have to stick a residence in each of those discrete spaces. So that's where this comes from. So we say we have 350 acres, 10 houses. We might stick 10 houses up in one corner in a nice little area, and then the rest of the acreage is an open area that's preserved. Or we might take those 10 houses and we might scatter them out so that each of them feels like they're living out in the country all by themselves. And they all have access to the common area. The open space is preserved. And somebody driving down the highway says, that looks a lot nicer than the cookie cutter deal. It also promotes developments where there may be better water on one part of it than another. And it allows them to put the residences where the water is. So now we get to the provision that's at issue here. We say that open area that's a ratio of how many homes are involved can be owned a couple of different ways. It may be owned, the whole thing may be deeded to the homeowner. So the homeowners own the open area, or we recognize a situation where the developer, and most of the time I think that's going to be an agricultural producer, commits an open area to satisfy the ratio with the cluster development. And so that leads to the two situations here. One is where the owners own it. The other is where I think the language is ownership is retained by the permit applicant. So we've got these two different ways that we have to address. Now, if the owners own it, it says common ownership. That can be either divided or undivided. You can own an undivided interest in a parcel of land. It is true that could be partitioned, and those could become segregated pieces in that open area. I don't dispute that could be done. I don't know why anybody would ever do it, but it could be done. If a court determined that there's some way to equally divide those, and that gets into a lot of questions where you have water rights and things, and so maybe it could be done or maybe it couldn't. I think the most common, I think the most common type of ownership would be undivided interest in a common tract. Those are tenants in common that own undivided interests. So the question is, and then the question came, why 65 years versus 99 years? That's just a debate we had in the committee. That's open to amendment on the floor if somebody wants to do it. I personally like 99 years better. The 65 years, I think, still promotes some two-generation estate planning that I just raises issues in my mind. But anyway, we settled on 65. It's subject to amendment by anyone who likes a different number. So for that 65 years, that land is going to be committed. I don't know exactly what the instrument in the county property records is going to be. I figured we'd leave that up to the planner. But somewhere or another, this thing is going to be a subdivision. It's going to be permitted as a subdivision. There's going to be a subdivision plat that's filed of record in the county records that shows the clusters and shows the open space. And that is going to burden that open space to remain as open space for the 65 years. And incidentally, we did the 35 thing in order to, as an inducement, to perhaps get people to do this. We even said, if you do a cluster subdivision and you do it right, then you can have a bonus and you can actually go, you can lower the ratio from 1 per 35 acres down to 1 per 17 and a half acres. And we felt that that gave an inducement to do these, and we felt that these things are good public policy. But there's going to be some kind of a plat that's filed in the county records. It's clearly going to delineate the open space. It's going to delineate the clusters. It's going to delineate the relationship between the two and the length of time that that open space must remain open. If it's the common ownership, then when it comes to the end of the 65 years, the question came up, does it come to an end? Is all the good work that we've done to preserve open space for 65 years just come to an end? And that's where the double generation estate planning, I can see some real games I could play with that. And so we said before that open area at the end of the 65-year period can be subject to ownership by somebody who might want to subdivide it or do it, other things with it. The people who benefit from it, who are the owners, the then-present owners of the residences that benefit from the open space, ought to have the first right to buy it. So that's a first right of possession. And we could work all day on all the micromanaging how this first right of possession is going to work. I think it's sufficient to say a court's going to have to say it's a bona fide offer. And if it's not a bona fide offer, then that's not a something that somebody that owns the first right has to respond to. But we want to have a first right for those people to meet an offer for that land and retain it in open space, because that very well may be, probably is, why they bought it in the first place, was its attractiveness and its attachment to the open space. We also have the other situation, which we recognize, where an ag producer could do a cluster subdivision and satisfy the ratio himself with property that's not owned by the people in the residences. And so how are we going to do that? So we gave a first right of refusal. Again, it's going to have to be a bona fide right, set a first right of refusal. If he's going to sell that off and destroy the ratio, destroy the open space that's part of what living here is all about, then we ought to have a first right to buy it at the same price. Now, I think I misspoke a little bit. On the common ownership, it just says that if the property owners own it and they own it in some sort of common ownership, there has to be some process by which they can retain the land in open space after 65 years. Probably that's a first right of refusal, but we didn't want to micromanage this any more than we wanted to, and there may be some other ways. But just so long as we require that there's a process, so when the 65 years expires, those people have an opportunity to continue, I won't say perpetuate, because they might not do it perpetually, but continue it on whatever terms they may wish, in the same manner that it was when they bought their property and probably was an inducement for them to live there. If that open space is owned by the developer, then it's encumbered. He can't develop it for 65 years, and at the end of that 65-year period, then before he could sell it to somebody else, there's a first right of refusal there that if he had a bona fide offer. And after all, how else are we going to do it? We can't micromanage it. We don't know what the land's going to be worth at that time. And we didn't want to lock that in. We felt that he ought to have the market value for his property, whatever it is, so long as it was a bona fide offer. So we think, with respect to the, I hope I've raised or answered all the objections that have been raised, but we felt without doing any more regulation or any more restriction on developers and people that live in these areas than we had to, we left a provision simply that they could protect themselves, that they bought this property, and as an adjunct to the property that they bought, they got a share of the open space, and whether it be their group that owns it in common ownership somehow, or whether it's the developer, there ought to be a way at the end of that that they could have a mechanism to continue the open space, which, as I say, is probably has a lot to do with why they lived there in the first place.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the explanation of the rationale behind the amendment. In hearing the explanation and looking at the language, another question comes to my mind that in the first division of division number two, if the area of open space is owned in common by the owners of the lots, then they can develop a process to retain the land in open space, and I think that's great. The next part of the second part of the division, if ownership of the open space is retained by the permit applicant, and I read that to mean 100% of the open space is retained by the applicant. So you either have a situation where the owners of the lots own the open space or the permit applicant owns the open space. If I were a developer, I would sell all but 1% of the open space so they could never exercise the right of refusal. I think there needs, you need to cover it more specifically. If you're really going to give a right of refusal, is it over everything that's, what is it over? Do you use the 80% or the 75% that we see in special district development type thing where 80% of the people need to consent? But certainly those things can be worked on in another amendment.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to that might be on page 3, lines 9 through 14. And that says an area within the cluster development, if you start at the top of the page, cluster development means a division of land that creates parcels containing less than 35 acres each, provided, and then those lines I cited says, an area within the county equal to not less than two-thirds of the total area being divided as reserved at the time of the development for the preservation of open space. Now, it's true the ownership might be split one way or the other, but I don't think that can be defeated in either one of these, and I think the speaker's right. If that doesn't fully cover it, I think an amendment could fix it.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't have enough background to talk about how this is, but I'm trying to understand this, and what it seems to me is that we're trying to find here, or that's being sought, is an answer to many different scenarios of how the property may be owned, and then at the end of this time when things have been designated at open space, then what becomes of the property? The assumption on page 6 is that the owners are going to want to, that a provision shall provide for the process in which the owners of the lot may retain the land in open space. But I would just suggest that we really don't know what the owners are going to want to do with the land in 65 years. It could be what we see in some of the subdivisions around the town where I'm from is the town has grown out around those subdivisions. And some of them, the highest use and the most value to the individuals may no longer be to have that much space. And they might want to go into more of a high-density development or something. So I guess that I'm curious as to whether or not how much micromanaging we can do, or whether there's steps that at the end of that period that was first designated and it's not under perpetual easement or something like that, is whether there can be a process written that I guess there's so many different options out there. I don't know. I'm not going to suggest any direction where it can go, and that's why I'm having trouble settling on one that's proposed here.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I think that a lot of those concerns that were expressed by the representative from Sheridan County is what drove the debate and ultimately drove us to reduce it from 99 years to 65 years, because 99 years seemed like a really long time. I might submit that, that we have a lot of activity in our state going on right now with conservation easements, and those things are permanent. And we were cognizant of that when we worked on this, and we thought about doing it similar to a conservation easement, and we didn't. One of my professors in property law in law school used to be fond of saying, you know, forever is a long time. And conservation easements are forever. And 99 years is a long time. So we went down to 65 years because times are going to change. I don't think any of us are going to be here when the first one of these that has a 65-year term on it expires. And so what will the situation be at that time? So the property will be owned. If it's owned by a developer, there's a first right of refusal. I think the more common situation will be that it's owned in common by those owners of the homes. Well, there will be a process there yet to be determined. We want to leave that for people to work out, that a process for them to maintain the open space. If that process can't succeed because they're not willing to do it or doesn't pass by a majority or however the drafter of the document sets up, then at that point the process fails or expires, and that may be because those people who own that land say, that's not the highest and best use anymore. We're not going to invoke this process for the purpose of perpetuating the open space, and we want to sell this land and get some money out of it, maybe a huge return. And we tried to leave as much flexibility there as we could, consistent with the objective of, at least for the rest of our lifetime, trying to answer the concerns of our citizens about open space and get away from this cookie-cutter situation.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you. Sitting and listening to all of this and going back to the bill and then going back to the amendment and back to the bill, I guess I need you to explain to me one more time what drove this legislation to start with. Why can't people that buy property decide if they want to develop that property or they don't want to develop that property, and why should they have to set it aside in some type of conservation district for 65 years or 95 years or 99 years or into perpetuity as in giving land up to a conservation district or conservation something or other we're doing? Maybe we're just getting a little too much into the people's business of what they do with their land.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, the 35 acres is a preordained requirement in our statutes that triggers all sorts of subdivision requirements. And I think unless we offer developers some other way to deal with that, they're going to stay at 35 or above. It's interesting. Last time we passed this thing, we called large lot subdivisions, in which we said the commissioners could, at their option, raise that 35 acres anywhere up to 140. It's my understanding three counties have done that. Mine is one. I don't know where the other two are. But out of 23 counties, there are still 20 counties that have the 35-acre minimum in there. If it goes below 35 acres in terms of concentration, then all the other subdivision regulations kick in. Developers don't want to do that. So we're trying to find another way that they can put the houses in an irregular pattern or perhaps more or less co-locate them within one part of the area, preserve the open space and the rest of it, and even give them a bonus to give them some inducement to do that. It, to try to get away from the cookie-cutter 35-acre thing. And without this, then they can do the same thing, but when they try to cluster those homes or not put them each on their 35-acre tract, they are going to run into those more rigid subdivision regulations that they're just not willing to invoke. So it's a balancing act. What we're trying to do is preserve the open space concept of one per 35 acres, but allow them the flexibility to do that without doing the cookie cutter thing.
Right. Any more discussion on Division 2? Okay. We are, the question has been called on Division 2 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 9. All those in favor of Division 2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Division 2 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed Committee of the Whole. Division has been called for. All those in favor of Division 2 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Division number 2 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has failed Committee of the Whole. And we are back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The difficulty with long debates is it gives me time to actually read the whole bill, and now I have lots of questions. My first question, perhaps to the good gentleman from Laramie County, there was a handout that came out with this that said this is at the option of the counties, and it pointed to page 2, line 2 through 5. But when I read that, I don't really see where it says it's the option. It just says it's vested. Perhaps an amendment of some sort could be put forward that says something to the effect they'll adopt it by resolution. Because the difficulty is then when you turn over to page 7 at the top, lines 2 through 6, it keeps saying the county commissioners shall adopt rules and regulations to implement the provisions of this article. So it seems to be saying two things. There sort of seems to be an attempt at the beginning to say it's at the option of the county, but then later on that they shall do this. If it stays an option of the county, I don't think I have that much objection to it, but I think it should be an option. And the primary reason is this. My county has zoning. We already have something very similar to this. My county was concerned that if this passes and that they have to do this would trump their zoning that they already have. I mean, clearly the intent of this bill is to get to those counties that don't have zoning and to get them to start implementing some type of zoning. And that's up to those counties. They can do what they want to do. But for those counties that already have zoning, I just wanted to make sure that they weren't going to be forced to do something less than, because this certainly is a lesser standard than my county has. My other concern, and I guess it's just a small concern, not a huge one, with last year's bill and this one, and then there's another one coming, the counties have, I mean, there's a case, Pedro Aspen out in Natrona County, went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was very clear, subdividing is in the purview of the legislature. Zoning is in the purview of the counties. I'm just concerned that we're turning into sort of the federal government where we dictate to the states how to do things, and here we are sort of melding into the zoning area where in the past we've left that up to the counties. If they wanted to do something, they could do it through their zoning power. If they didn't want to do it, they didn't have to do it. I'm not really seeing the need for this bill. I mean, clearly, counties already do this. They have zoning. I'm just confused as to why we're even doing this. But I guess my more important question is there any way we could amend this, and would you be amenable to amending it to make it clear this truly is an option type bill?
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read through this bill, I become increasingly concerned about the state's role in land use planning. And I fundamentally believe that should be done at the county level. And I realize that the way this was structured was intended to be an option. I have some of the same concerns as my good colleague from the north that maybe that's not the case, and hopefully we can clarify that as we proceed. But this is the state, in my opinion, putting the binky in the mouth of those counties that are not willing to go through zoning. And ultimately, it should be their purview to decide that that is the right thing to do, and those counties need to take that step. I realize that it's politically difficult, but to expect the legislature to do it just because it's politically difficult is not necessarily the right answer. And I have some concerns with this bill and would be interested to have further discussion as to its necessity. Thank you.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is supposed to be an option. Those counties in this state that have voted on zoning, more power to them. There are some counties that have chosen not to do zoning, and they have been fraught and with 35-acre subdivisions that, as my good friend from across the hill says, cookie cutter. And it's a mess. We've let the horse out of the barn in some areas. This is supposed to be a tool. It is not the heavy hand of government coming down on the counties. It is, and I would, as chairman of the Corporations Committee, I would welcome the good representative from the land of the deep snow to go ahead and come up with an amendment. It is a tool, and that's what we did last year when we passed the 35-acre subdivision. It's a tool for the counties. My county here, county commissioners have said, the horse is out of the barn, he's out of the pasture, and he's in the great big field beyond, so we're not going to do anything. Well, I don't agree with that either, but at least they have the tool that if they decide to do it, they can do it. So this bill is merely another way of having subdivisions, of having an option for the county to go ahead and do it. So I would urge you to go ahead and come up with an amendment and make it so that it is optional for those counties that do not have zoning.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple other questions that page 5 of the bill, line 6, this is section 185403. I wonder how that subparagraph A, whether that is consistent or inconsistent with House Bill 10, the other subdivision bill, page 3, line 2 of that, where what we've done in House Bill 10 is to say that no person shall, and rather than use the word subdivide, we use the word sell. No person shall sell land subject to subdivision regulation under this article or commence construction without a permit. Because we've had people subdividing land or selling land even though there was no subdivision permit. That seems a bit backwards, and I think that's what was intended to correct in House Bill 10. I wonder, should that be in House Bill 9 on page 5? Because we're still using the word divide or commence construction. And that language is also in House Bill 10 on page 2, section 185302. My second question, on page 5, line 18, where we've got this is no permit shall be approved until B1 is a plat, is approved by the board and recorded with the county clerk. And then it says designating on line 18 and clearly noting the duration of the open space. I wonder if the more appropriate word is dedicating, since that's what the plat does. Subparagraph 2, page 5. A provision is approved by the board providing for the retention and maintenance of the open space. I think the intent of the words retention and maintenance is that it will remain in open space for the 65 years. Maintenance means you're going to maintain the open space to me. And I'm not sure that was the intent, if you retain it, you maintain it. And I think you don't need the word maintenance in there. If all you're intending is that you're preserving the open space, and really it's a dedication of open space throughout, regardless of how you do it, whether it's an easement or a deed restriction or whatever. So maybe you could just address those things. And I do believe that this bill needs to go forward. It is a tool that counties need, and it is good that we are paying close attention to it. Thank you.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the privilege of sitting on the committee that heard this bill for about a year. And one of the things that I found was coming from the counties themselves. This is something they feel they need. It's a tool whereby they can actually serve the people in the county better. One of the examples that came before the committee was when they have these parcels of land of 35 acres, people could build anywhere on that 35 acres that they chose. The only thing is, the county does not know where some of those homes are. They ran into instances of fire and ambulance service where they did not know where they were. They are hoping that a tool like the cluster subdivisions would help there be a little bit more of a design. There was one instance that was related that a person died because the ambulance service could not find them. It's hoped that by having something like the cluster subdivisions, that the counties have a little better tool to serve the people, and that they have a little more of a way to address some of the needs that might arise. There may be some problems that you're seeing with this bill, or some things that maybe need to be addressed, and I think that's great. But I hope that this body will consider that this is just another tool that we can give the county commissions to address the needs in their counties. Thank you.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer some of the concerns, first from the good speaker, listening to him and reading through, I think we can make the necessary amendments in all three of those sections and words, and I do believe he makes good points. The good representative from Jackson asked two questions, and of course I'm not a lawyer and don't do this for a living, but on page one when you do the authority section in 185401, it says in there it's vested in the Board of County Commissioners, and then again on 185403, it basically says no person shall, right now it says divide land, without first obtaining a permit. If the Board of County Commissioners doesn't want to give you a permit, that is basically, maybe that's not as strong as it should be in the law, but that is, I guess, the teeth and the discretion if a county wants to take this option or not. In regards to his second question and the echoing from the good representative from Lingle, you know, zoning is a bad word around the state, and we still have problems going on. Counties don't want to do it. They don't have the political muster sometimes, so they come to us and look for more tools in their toolbox to do indirect ways of zoning with, I guess, better names like conservation design or fixes that the state legislature can do to aid them without ever having to go to that dreaded Z word, which we hear in the Corporations Committee a lot. So counties aren't doing it right now. That doesn't mean the legislature shouldn't. Yes, I think all of us in here agree that the county should be doing it and the authority is vested in them. But in the absence of them providing real leadership, something has to be done, and that's why it's on our desk right now.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as the presenter just said, we can address some of these things in amendments. And I don't want to drag this out, but just quickly, I think under House Bill 10, we're trying to make a change so that a developer can do some preliminary tests in the market, take some earnest money deposits on property, and contract for the development of property, do some early work before he has to front end the entire infrastructure. It's just become incredibly burdensome to tell someone that you can't even take an earnest money deposit until you've built the entire infrastructure. So I think that lines 6, 7, and 8 on page 5 are consistent with that. If they're not, we can work on that. As far as using the word dedicating instead of designating, we do have a case in the state of Wyoming that says dedicating is tantamount to a deed in fee simple. And that's why I chose to use the word designating instead of dedicating. As far as retention and maintenance, it's probably the word maintenance is probably redundant and isn't needed. So I don't think those are problems that can't be addressed with an amendment, and I would urge passage of this bill. I think it really gives your county commissioners another tool. Some will use, some won't. But for those who want it, they desperately want some ways to do a better job of managing growth and development in their counties, and this is a great tool for them to have available.
Any more discussion on the bill? The question being called, all those in favor of Representative Villeway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 9 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 9 has passed Committee of the Whole. Madam Majority Whip, will you come take the chair?
Excuse me. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 10. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 10, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to subdivision requirements. This bill was went to Committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which respectfully reported back with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Dirks, Hales, Illaway, Lubno, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that House Bill 10 do pass. And I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, which will be discussed by my good friend from House District 56.
Representative Stubson.
Madam Chairman, you have just received some foreshadowing of this bill, and let me talk specifically about the area that is addressed by the Standing Committee Amendment first. As part of this bill, there was included a requirement that in order to issue a subdivision permit, an applicant had to show that there was in place a homeowners association. And there, this is on pages 7 through, I'm sorry, pages 3 through 5 of the bill. It lays out those issues and those areas that the homeowners subdivision or the homeowners association had to deal with, including maintenance of common areas, roads, water supplies, the homeowners association management, and provisions for dispute resolution. The concern that was raised in the committee among a number of folks in the room was requiring this in all circumstances. There was some feeling that there may be a number of subdivisions that may not be appropriate to require. For example, if you've got, you know, 3 or 4 folks in the subdivision that are related, maybe in that circumstance it's not appropriate to require a homeowners association. There was also discussion that there may be other tools and options available to deal with these same issues. And so in order to answer that concern, the committee did amend the bill, and this is Standing Committee Amendment number 1, to make that requirement an option. And what it does is it gives the county the authority to require that, but it doesn't necessarily require every county in every circumstance with every subdivision to require a homeowners association. So with that, I would present the Standing Committee Amendment.
Chairman Childers, a question on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1.
No, ma'am. I'm Madam Chairman, I'm actually standing in opposition to the Standing Committee amendment. You know, I brought this bill, a similar bill before, and quite frankly, I think mandatory associations, and people have to realize just because they form the association, they don't have to do anything about the maintenance. They don't have to do anything about the water supply systems, and they don't have to do anything about the irrigation system. But the problem is that the counties have been dealing with, and I've talked to a number of the counties, the problems that they're dealing with is the subdivision people come in, or owners of the subdivision lots come in and complain to the county, and the county basically can't do anything. And the purpose of setting this up is to have an association and say, govern yourself. That's the purpose of it. Govern yourself. You know, just like local school control, govern yourself. And it resolves a lot of problems. And I personally think that it's time that the subdivisions basically form and do the things that they should do, or at least lay out a record that the county understands that they can do that. And I understand what the purpose is. Some counties don't want to have to do anything about it. But quite frankly, I think we have problems all over the state with the smaller subdivisions because they don't do something. But before they can complain to the commissioners, they have to go ahead and take care of it themselves. And if there's a conflict on it, other things in the bill takes care of that they can mediate those problems. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm owning against the amendment.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a question about the amendment. When I read the amendment in on page 3, line 12, the board shall require, and with respect to paragraph Romanet 12 of this subparagraph, may require the following information to be submitted with each application for permit. Provided the board may by rule exempt from any of the following requirements of this subsection or subsection C of this section, and shall exempt from paragraph 12 of this subsection the subdivision of one or more units. Maybe it's just me, but the amendment says the board may require it. Line 16 says it shall be exempt. Can you help me out there?
Mr. Speaker, it's only exempt in limited circumstances under the current language. It talks about those subdivisions of 1 to 5 units. What this does is exempt it allows the county the option on a much broader level to require it on any subdivision. So while it does have the exemption for those limited smaller subdivisions, what the committee did is allow the commission to exempt all subdivisions if they so choose from that requirement.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. Speaking on and for the amendment, as the good representative from House District 14, Albany County, tells us, not all subdivisions are cookie cutter. And it's difficult, I think, for us to impose requirements on things that we don't know a lot of detail about. And legislative restraint, I think, is appropriate because we don't know all of the situations sitting here in Laramie. We all have a mental picture of one type of subdivision in our mind, but there's a whole myriad type of subdivisions. What this amendment does is it gives the county commissioners the discretion in their best judgment to require a homeowners association or not. And the county commissioners know that if they don't require a homeowners association in some circumstances, that 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, the people in that subdivision are going to be showing up at the county commission saying, we have problem X, please pay to fix it. So this gives a tool to the county commissions to plan their future, but it also, by having this amendment, lowers what I call the nonsense quotient, which is the amount of make work work that you have to do to go through stuff that you don't really need to do. And so this amendment lowers that nonsense quotient as much as possible so that you don't have to do things that make sense. But it gives the discretion to your county commissioners to be able to do that.
Chairman Childers.
Madam Majority Whip, there's another aspect of a group that has some problems with this. And if you've lived in these minor subdivisions and you've had irrigation problems, and note that this bill does bring the irrigation issue into it, you talk to the ditch rider or you talk to the district superintendent of the irrigation district, and they say, not my problem. Once it goes past the gate, not my problem. So who do you turn to take care of those problems? You can't go to the county commissioners. But if you have an association and you set up a system of control or at least notification of how these irrigation systems are going to work, and you got to remember when the subdivisions are formed, there has to be a plat provided and other information like that that shows that the irrigation systems have been taken care of by that developer. And then also, if you've gone into any problems with the road maintenance, that you have to go to all the landowners, and there's by hook or crook that you get it taken care of. But if you set it up in the subdivision that you're able to do that, same way with the water supply system. I've talked to lots of subdivisions that they formed an association like that. And, boy, their water systems, it just goes like clockwork in being able to pay for maintenance of that. And people take care of going out there and upgrading them. Same way with the roads and so forth. And what you're doing is making it arbitrary. In other words, yeah, they may do it. And then I'll guarantee you, because I've heard the commissioners talk about it, those homeowners are going to go in there and just say, hey, I got this problem. Do something about it. Well, they haven't set up a system that they can govern themselves in the first place. Again, on and against the amendment.
Representative Stubson.
Just a final argument on the amendment. I think the good representative from Park County makes a good argument why county commissioners want to utilize this tool. I do not think, however, that's a compelling argument about why we don't want, why we should not give them the choice to utilize the tool.
You have heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On that same page 3, as I understand it, if it's a subdivision of 1 to 5 lots, it shall be exempt from Romanet 12. Why is there a distinction on that exemption between that and a 6-lot subdivision? Why is that not a may rather than shall on line 16 that would allow the commissioners to go to that level? And I fully understand why we, in the subdivision statutes, created the smaller subdivision so they didn't have to go through all of those all of the DEQ things that were making it, were really grinding subdivisions to a halt in Wyoming because it was so onerous. But if you have a
small subdivision of five lots of 10 acres apiece, and they're all on the same ditch. Can we not at least allow the commissioners to afford the same opportunity to those small lot owners in a small subdivision to try and work these things out? Not that I totally agree with all of the arbitration and mediation provisions in here, but why is it mandated to be that it's exempt?
Representative Stubson.
Madam Chairman, I think the provision that you draw, that our attention is drawn to, is the good explanation for it is that it's simply a matter of compromise. There was, trying to reflect back on the interim discussion, there was a feeling among some that those smaller subdivisions, 1 to 5, shouldn't be, in no circumstance, should be placed under this requirement that they go through and form a homeowners association, maybe form a nonprofit corporation that is part of that homeowners association. And so the provision that gained the support through the interim and into committee was to just take that off the table. We are going to give the commissioners the option for those bigger subdivisions over 5, but on those 1 to 5, we're going to just say, hey, those are small enough that they shouldn't have to deal with this requirement, and we shouldn't have to impose it on it. And that's, I guess, the best explanation I can give on that particular portion of it. The bill does two other things, really, besides the homeowners provision that we've been discussing. And one of the, I guess, the meat of the bill on page 2, A5, is to change the definition of the term sell or sale for purposes of the subdivision statute. And Representative Brown spoke to this already about how this impacts the ability to market these properties before a subdivision is actually approved. As the law stands now, there's a real handcuffing, I guess, of developers who want to go out and test the market and see, is my 40-acre tract better sold in 4 lots or 5 lots? Can I get enough money to pay estate taxes by selling a 10-acre parcel, or do I need to go to a 15-acre parcel? Well, you can't market those unless you go through the rigors of a subdivision approval process. And then if you get to the end of that process, figure out the way you've done it isn't the best, then you have to turn around, additional expenditure and hassle for the county planning folks, and do it all over again. And so what this provision is aimed at doing is saying, yeah, you can go out and do that. You can explore the market. You can see what is the best way to do it. And then at that point, but prior to sale, come in and go through the planning process, the subdivision process. And we believe that's a more efficient approach to that process. The other two provisions, or the other group of provisions in the bill, is really to sort of beef up the notice requirements in the subdivision statutes to comply in some respects with what we did in large acre subdivisions last year, and those being the notification of water rights, specifically irrigation rights on a given parcel, as well as notification to folks that their surface use is subject to development of the mineral estate. And again, that sort of reflects what we did in the large acre subdivision and is an effort to make sure that when you buy a piece of property, you understand the full aspect of your ownership rights. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Chairman Gingery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is on page 6, subsection B. It's dealing with the mediation section, and it says that homeowners, when they're fighting, have to go to mediation. And maybe, I guess I disagree with that, but what I really disagree with is the placement of where this is situated. Because if you actually look on the page before, on page 5, it starts at the bottom of the page on line 21, it's enforcement. This enforcement, what they're talking about is when someone violates the rules that the county put down for subdividing, and then the county goes to enforce. The difficulty is that when you read B, it says, before civil proceedings may be brought pursuant to subsection A, all disputes arising under homeowners must be mediated. You could almost argue
that when the county goes to enforce their own rules, the county is going to be forced to go to mediation. The county shouldn't be forced to go to mediation. The county should be allowed to enforce the rules as quickly as they can. It's actually, the other problem is homeowners association are private entities. The county should have nothing to do with them. These are entities that we don't want to have anything to do with. These are neighbors that get mad at each other over covenants which within their own neighborhood. When counties start getting involved with the covenants, this is opening a huge Pandora's box. The county should just worry about their own rules, not about private entities' rules. I understand this encouraging them to mediate, or actually it's forcing them to mediate, but number one, I don't think counties should get anywhere involved with homeowners associations. And number two, the placement of this just seems to be in an odd place. It seems to be implying that the counties could not enforce their own rules unless they mediated. And I was just wondering if the committee had considered maybe a different place for this or some different language possibly.
Representative Stubson.
Madam Chairman, there was no discussion of a different placement of that provision, but I think the representative from Teton County raises some concerns that probably need to be looked at prior to second reading. There is a provision on page 4, lines 12 through 16, that within the mechanism of the homeowners association, they have to provide in their rules for this mediation and arbitration. And so I think that that other provision probably bears some looking at before Second Amendment or second reading.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been dealing with these homeowners associations as a water commissioner, and the concerns brought up by the two representatives are very valid. I just would really like these homeowners associations to take care of themselves. So when somebody creates this subdivision, the homeowners association takes over just about all the things that are in there as a water commissioner, because the homeowners association is not well organized. As soon as one person doesn't get their lot of water, and when we're talking about a second foot of water divided into 70 acres, and then you divide each acre into a lot, maybe, you know, a third of an acre, and they call up and say, we want our water. Well, the state engineer shouldn't have to deal with that. And I think it's strictly a homeowners association. So I would like these homeowners associations to really take control of the subdivision and take care of the problems within, not get the state, not get the county. And if this bill is trying to get homeowners to take over the responsibility of running all the little things, the disagreements that happen within that association, I'm all for this. And I guess I would just ask, is this the intent of this, to relieve the state and relieve the county of all of the squabblings that do go in with homeowners associations? Thank you.
Representative Stubson.
Madam Chairman, I think the representative from the southwest portion of the state spoke very well to why this is included in the bill, and that really is the motivation, which is let's try to put some onus on homeowners in these subdivisions to take care of these issues themselves before they come to the state seeking state funds to remedy water situations, road situations, and those sorts of things.
Mr. Speaker.
But, Madam Chairman, you're not allowing them to do that in the small lot subdivisions when it says that they shall be exempt from paragraph 12. But that wasn't my point for standing up. But page 3 at the top, lines 3 through 7, no person, and the word subdivide is defined in 303 or 301, excuse me, 18.5.302. And then the word sell is defined in both House Bill 10 and that amends the definition in 302. So if you change the definition in 304 from subdivide to sell, what tells me I can't subdivide without a permit?
Representative Stubson.
I can't point you to any particular, Madam Chairman, I can't point to a particular statute that addresses that. Changes as have been made by the committee simply ensures that you're not going to sell that without subdivision. As far as subdividing, moving forward possibly with surveying, platting, doing some of those initial things that are part of the subdivision process, you can do that prior to getting a subdivision permit.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Well, maybe somebody can help me on this. I know Title 30, 35, 32, something also addresses this, but if it's not addressed somewhere else, and you're, then we have no requirement anymore that you need a permit to subdivide. And the whole intent of that original definition was that people aren't going to go out and subdivide land. We have plenty of subdivisions in this state that sit empty for a variety of reasons. And they never, we don't have an automatic reversion. Some counties may have adopted, you know, if you haven't developed it within 2 years, it's withdrawn. But I think that's generally with a land use, not a subdivision. Once it's platted, it's platted until it's revoked. And you can revoke a subdivision, but that's not the name of it. You can revoke a subdivision if all of the owners of the lots in it agree, or then you have to go through another process. But maybe you can enlighten me.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairman, I think 18.5304 existing law says no person shall subdivide land or commence the physical layout or construction of a subdivision without first obtaining a subdivision permit from the board of the county in which the land is located. So you can't do, and subdivide means...
Madam Chairman, point of order. You're reading from the 2007 statute that we amended, and it no longer contains the word physical layout in the 2008 provision. So what you're seeing in House Bill 3 on page 3 that's not stricken is the land that's in the 2008 supplement, and it doesn't contain the physical layout language. Maybe it should, but that's still – I can go physically lay out the subdivision with a surveyor, but that still doesn't say I can't plat it. So I have a surveyor give me a record of survey that subdivides my land, and I record it, and there's nothing that says I can't do that.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chairman, thank you, Mr. Speaker, for encouraging me to use the current statute. But it does say no person shall subdivide land or commence construction of a subdivision without obtaining a subdivision permit. That's the current statute. And subdivide land means the creation or division of a lot, tract, parcel, or other unit of land for the immediate or future purpose of sale, building, development, or redevelopment for residential, recreational, industrial, commercial, or public uses. And then just to nail it down, our statute does say the word subdivide or any derivation thereof shall have reference to the term subdivision. So as the current statutory scheme stands, I don't think a landowner can do anything in furtherance of a subdivision without getting the subdivision permit first. And this, getting a subdivision permit first requires one to go through the entire process. What we're trying to do here is create a process that would allow a developer or an owner of land to do some exploratory work. Survey it, carve up parcels, put a map up on the wall, make preliminary sales on contracts that are going to be contingent on that subdivision plan being approved, take some earnest money and understand where he is in the market before he makes these huge front-end commitments of capital. And to the extent that this needs some fine-tuning with an amendment, we wouldn't be hostile to that. But that is the big picture of what we're trying to do here, because it has just become so onerous on a developer that there's a lot of subdivision that isn't being done, or it's being done piecemeal in smaller pieces, because that's the only way a person can gauge the market without overextending himself.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't disagree with the concept of allowing someone to determine whether they pro forma they have something that's going to work, but that is a huge change from subdivide to sell. I just have to tell you, over my years here, there's been a lot of discussion over the word subdivide and what that means. And if we take it out, and there's no other provision in the statute that says you can't subdivide before you get a permit, we're going to have all kinds of subdivisions. We're going to have recording issues. Some counties won't want to record them because they'll say you don't have a permit, and it'll just be a mess. So we need to fix it.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 10 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Bill 10 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 79. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill 79, introduced by Representative Brown, an act relating to real estate mortgages redemption period. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, which respectfully reported back with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Korberg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Gingrey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 79 do pass, and I would turn it over to the good representative from Albany County to explain.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this bill, I did have the prudence, ladies and gentlemen, to enlist the speaker as a co-sponsor. I think that may prove immensely helpful. This is a mere clarification of a statute that I think we all thought we knew what it meant. We all think we knew what it meant, but when we worked on this last year and changed the redemption acreage from 20 acres to 80 acres, a question came up about whether this statute was ambiguous. And we had all read the statute for years and years and understood the statute to say that if a mortgage recites in the body that the encumbered property is agricultural real estate, that meant that the redemption period for agricultural real estate would apply. And that would be 12 months instead of the standard redemption period of 3 months. And as we read that statute, I wasn't able to fully put to rest the fact that Section C was a little bit ambiguous in that respect. So this merely adds the language you see on line 5 of page 2 and line 6 of page 2 to make crystal clear in this statute what we all understood that it meant. So I would stand for questions. I would urge your approval of this bill.
Any further discussion of the bill? The question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 79 do pass,
please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 79 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Yay. You have heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 4, recommended do pass. House Bill 11, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 80, amended as follows, recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again. Motion prevailed. House Bill 50, recommended do pass. House Bill 22, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 102, amended. Representatives Davis Wanitzer, and Gilmore announced a conflict of interest on House Bill 102. Recommended do pass. House Bill 9, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 10, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 79, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Stubson, Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Stubson. Great job. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have messages from the Senate, reports from standing committees, and then adoption of rules, so we have a little more work to do. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 8. Mr. Speaker, this is to inform you that the Senate has adopted the temporary Senate and joint rules of the 60th Wyoming State Legislature with the following amendments as the permanent Senate and joint rules of the 60th. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, message 100. The bills listed below passed on Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 3, Abandoned Mine Reclamation Liens, Ayes 30, No 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 101, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 25, District Court's Release of Information, Ayes 29, No 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 102, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 44, Pipeline Inspection and Safety, Ayes 30, No 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 103, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 49, Psychologist Licensure, Ayes 21, Noes 9, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 19, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarberg, Throne, signed Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 20, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Throne. No, Mercer, Peasley, Quarburg. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 49, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 137, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 90, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jorgensen, Betterson, Philp, Stewart, excused, Hammonds. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 91, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp. No, Stewart. Excused, Hammonds. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 118, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jorgensen, Pedersen, Philp, Stewart, excused, Hammonds, signed, Representative Berger, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number three, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 95, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Miller, Peterson, Semlek. No, Madden, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred House Bill 53, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom is referred House Bill 119, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House rules and the joint rules previously adopted as the temporary rules of the House of Representatives of the 60th Legislature be adopted together with any amendments approved by the House as the permanent rules of the House of Representatives of the 60th Legislature.
You have heard the motion. Before voting on the motion to adopt the temporary rules as the permanent rules, the House will first consider any proposed amendments to the temporary rules. Amendments to the temporary rules require a majority vote for adoption, and we'll talk about the proposed amendments right now.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Madam Majority Whip. I move Joint Rule 0001 to the permanent rules, and that is, you have a packet on your desk that was handed out to you. It says at the top right, JR0001/. And then it's two pages, and then if you go to the third page, you'll see that first page again with some diagramming on it, and that shows you that 21, the proposed amendment to the joint rule 21-1A is the same as House Rule 6. And then the current practice in subparagraph B, and then the new practice. Page 5 of the handout shows you the current practice of amendments, and that is the insert and strike language that we see. The next page says at the top, amendments in context. That is what the proposed rule proposed, is that amendments would come out in context. So you can see, for instance, page 2 of that proposed amendment, the current practice, and then the amendments in context, shows the whole paragraph with the insertion underlined. And I'm on the amendments in context page, lines 6 through 10. Currently, you would only see what's on line 10 as an insertion. With the amendment in context, you see much more of it. You see that on Romanet 3A. 3B shows you what is stricken. So that is the difference between the way we currently do it as the current practice and the amendments in context. We are proposing to adopt the amendment in context process. We believe it will be easier to follow. We had discussion in the Rules Committee about division of amendments. Would it be harder to divide an amendment as an amendment in context? And just this afternoon, I divided one of those amendments, and the second amendment division went into the body of a paragraph and divided it halfway through the line. That's kind of what you would see in a division to an amendment in context. Say, for instance, on this amendment in context page, somebody wanted to divide it. You could divide it as we do now. You just pick the division, and it'd probably be easier for the chair to determine whether that is a valid division. But if you have any questions about that, please ask. That was the discussion in the Rules Committee, and I stand for questions on the joint rule.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to also add, because it was a little confusing in Rules Committee at the time, the amendments in context is just another option. We're not going to that wholesale. So what LSO will do is, if there's a particular amendment that is susceptible to being divided, then they probably will draft the amendment in the old style. And if you look on, I guess they're not numbered, but if you look on page 2, 4 of the handout on that summary, the next to the last bullet point there in bold kind of explains. It just allows LSO some latitude in drafting the amendment. So if it's an easy amendment, it'll be in context, but it's not necessarily going to be that way.
Madam Majority Whip, and this does create the new joint rule, as you can see on page 3 of the handout. We have the language in House Rule 6, and the Majority Floor Leader is exactly right. It does provide us an option under B2 of the proposed rule. And you'll see on page 3 or page 4 the summary of what's kind of shown in the diagramming. And I will stand for questions.
Are there any other questions? You have heard the motion. And the motion is to create Joint Rule 21-1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Majority Whip. I move, and this is in your packet also, third page from the bottom, Joint Rule 2, to amend Joint Rule 16-1A2 to include a reference in subparagraph A2 to the House rule, because we do have that House rule and it did not reference it in the joint rule, and that's all that is. It's just a cross-reference.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor of Joint Rule Number 2, which amends Joint Rule 16-1, subsection A, subsection 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion carries. Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor, Majority Whip. I move House Rule Number 1, which would amend House Rule 9-3A and House Rule 24-7E. And you can see the underlined language in 9-3A that would be added to 9-3A. And this clarifies that except for technical corrections to an amendment offered during floor debate, the House shall take no action on any proposed amendment until the amendment has been reduced to writing, approved by the House Attorney, and distributed to the members of the House. The change in 24-7E makes that provision consistent with the change in 9-3A. The way we've been operating in the House is that under 9-3A, where it says no bill shall be amended, there's nothing that says no amendment cannot be amended orally, except for legislative procedures, which is what we refer to when there's nothing referenced in our rule. We then go to the Legislative Procedures Manual, and that says, historically, the only amendments allowed to an amendment are technical corrections. We thought it best to be consistent with the Senate practice that any amendment to either a bill or an amendment other than a technical correction requires that it be in writing. I stand for questions.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I may have been a lone voice in that, but I didn't see it quite as the good speaker explained it. As you can see in 27.4E, currently it is a rule that amendments to a bill are going to be in written form when submitted. So we've seen that today. We've seen a lot of amendments come onto the bills, and they've all been written. But what this change does is, if it is currently the practice of the House, though seldom used, and that's why I'm not sure that we need to change that, that an amendment can be made to an amendment, and that that amendment to an amendment can be made on the floor from one of these speakers, from one of these microphones. And so now what we're doing is we're restricting ourselves from doing that. And I'm always worried whenever we restrict ourselves for an imagined reason, whenever we haven't really seen the real necessity to do it. And in fact, there is some precedent for not doing this in changes that have been made in the past. There have been made in the past amendments to amendments that have changed the dollar amount in budget bill. There have been changes in the past by making an amendment to an amendment in who a report would go to. And so I would just caution the body to think about this carefully, whether you want to take this right away from yourself to make an amendment to an amendment, that it would have to be written now, whereas before, if you saw something that you thought was a fatal flaw or something that that could be changed by amending an amendment is that can be done. But once we pass this bill, then there has to be another process if you want to slow the bill down from going through in order to make an amendment. And if it's on third reading, it's just too late.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you. You want to remember that when it's obvious it needs to be changes, we can suspend any rule with a two-thirds vote. And so I think we still have that protection when it's obvious that we need to amend an amendment.
I thought you said representative and then you said no instead of Representative Lubna. It's the first day with the New Year's. I'm sorry, Madam Majority Floor Leader. As you all know, this process was designed, and it was designed to be difficult, and it was designed to be cumbersome, and it was designed to be plodding, and it was designed to be slow. And the reason was you wanted to avoid a knee-jerk reaction in the sense of passion or after a good speech. There are some speakers who can stand at this microphone and say, black is white. And you sit there and you think, you know, I never thought about it like that. And then you get home and you think, what was I thinking? This process is designed to avoid that practice. And it was the practice in the House for many, many, many years until a clever person of my profession read the rules and said, well, that's an amendment to any bill. That doesn't say an amendment to any amendment. And so we started getting around a rule that we had had for ourselves. Particularly in these times where our finances are not as lucrative as they should be, budget amendments deserve scrutiny. They deserve scrutiny of the chairman. They deserve scrutiny of this body. We deserve to think about them, and we deserve to weigh financial priorities. And changing a budget amendment to double a number in the budget is problematic, and I don't think it's good public policy. We need to be disciplined with ourselves, and we have to be slow, plodding, and have careful scrutiny. If we do make a legitimate mistake, and we have made mistakes in the past, as the good chairman from the southeast corner of the state says, we have mechanisms to suspend the rules. And we've done it in the past where we've had three readings in a day on a bill to fix mistakes. So when we make a legitimate mistake, we can fix that mistake, but we should force ourselves to be disciplined, and that's what the purpose of this rule change is.
Is there any other discussion on the motion? Are you ready for the question? Chairman Landon.
Madam Chair, I'll make a couple last comments and give the speaker the last chance, if he wants. The case that the good representative from Campbell County talked about is actually a double-edged sword. It could be that what he speaks of is someone with the golden tongue, which may be able to influence a change that hasn't been considered a great deal. I'm not too worried about that. I think there's a lot of critical thinking going on in here. And the other side of that double-edged sword is there might be something going through that really does need to be changed, and yet we would be constricted from that. A two-thirds majority, a supermajority, is really fairly difficult to achieve, and as it should be. And I guess I am just very concerned that we would be giving up our ability to do this by passing this motion, because what that would mean is whatever had been previously written is going to be considered, but whatever may come up in argument or discussion is pretty much off the floor. We can't change it to accommodate any new information that comes by discussion. And so I would just urge the body to resist this amendment. I don't think we need it. I think we're working fine with the rules that we're presently working under. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just remember, we've been operating under the assumption that the only amendment you can make to an amendment is a technical correction. That's been the ruling from the Rules Committee, typically, and would be today, most likely. The Rules Committee, or the person in the chair, can first have the decision of what is a technical amendment. And there is some discretion there. And we do have the right to do other procedural things to try and address issues and bills that might need to be corrected. But if we just simply allow oral amendments to amendments, it will be a mess on this floor. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called, all those in favor of Mr. Speaker's motion that House Rule Number 1 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
House Rule Number 1 passes. Mr. Speaker.
I move House Rule Number 2, which is to amend House Rule 4-1. We would delete the current required practice that is not followed and insert a practice that is followed.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Question being called. All those in favor of Mr. Speaker's motion that House Rule Number 2 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Rule Number 2 has been adopted.
There being no further amendments, the question is, Representative Yagi. The question is, shall the temporary House rules and joint rules as amended be adopted as the permanent rules of the House of Representatives of the 60th Legislature? A majority vote is required for adoption of the motion. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson. Aye. Bagby. Aye. Barbuto.
Aye.
Berger.
Excused.
Berger excused. Blake.
Aye.
Bonner.
Aye.
Brechtel.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Buchanan.
Aye.
Byrd.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Carson. No.
Carson.
No.
Childers.
Aye.
Cohey.
Aye.
Connolly.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Davison.
Aye.
Dirks.
No.
Edmonds.
Aye.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Gilmore.
Aye.
Gingery.
Aye.
Goggles.
Aye.
Hales.
Yeah.
Hallinan.
Aye.
Hammonds.
Excused.
Hammonds excused. Harshman. Harshman excused. Harvey.
Aye.
Illaway.
Aye.
Yagi.
Aye.
Jorgensen.
Excused.
Jorgensen excused. Landon.
No.
Lockhart.
Aye.
Lubno.
Aye.
Madden.
Aye.
McKim.
Aye.
McComey.
Aye.
Mercer.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Millen.
Aye.
Moniz.
Aye.
Patton.
Aye.
Peasley.
Aye.
Pedersen. Pedersen excused. Peterson.
Aye.
Philp.
Excused.
Philp excused. Korberg.
Aye.
Roscoe.
Aye.
Semlich.
Aye.
Shepperson.
Aye.
Stewart.
Excused.
Stewart excused. Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
Aye.
Thompson.
Aye.
Throne.
Aye.
Wallace.
Aye.
Zwanitzer Dan.
Aye.
Zwanitzer Dave.
Aye.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Millen, no to aye. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 49 ayes, 4 noes, 7 excused.
By your vote, you have adopted the temporary House rules and joint rules as amended to be the permanent rules of the House of Representatives of the 60th Legislature. Committee announcements. Excuse me, Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just wanted to let everybody know we're glad to have the new representatives here, and we have one that had a birthday yesterday, and I sure wouldn't want the guy from Star Valley to go away without thinking we recognize he's getting 1 year older and smarter. Could we sing happy birthday to him?
Who is it?
Oh, Representative Robert McKim.
I will.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will be meeting this afternoon 10 minutes after adjournment in H-17 to hear House Bill 105, Notification of Bloodborne Pathogens, and House Bill 92, Long-Term Care Partnership Program.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet Tuesday upon noon recess. A change of rooms, note, room 302 we will meet in, and we'll discuss House Joint Resolution 3, Legislators Terms of Office, House Bill 182, Low Profit Limited Liability Companies, and House Bill 117, Campaign Finance.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock in room H-18, and we will consider the following bills. House Bill 109, Wyoming Community Facilities Program. House Bill 110, Wyoming Business Ready Community Program. And House Bill 112, Workforce Housing Program.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning, Tuesday, January 20th, at 8 a.m. to discuss House Bill 12, Brand Inspection Fees, House Bill 17, Livestock and Brands, House Bill 13, Subdivision Fences, and House Bill 15, Common School Trust Land Management Account. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet 10 minutes upon adjournment tonight in room 302 to take up House Bill 114, Community College Amendments.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8 on Highways and Transportation will meet tomorrow night, Tuesday, that's January 20th, somewhere around 15 minutes upon adjournment in room H-17 to discuss the following three bills. House Bill 2, Street Rods and Custom Vehicles. House Bill 25, Special License Plate Retention by Spouse, and House Bill 51, Handicapped Motorcycle License Plates.
The House Committee Chairman and leadership will meet in H-10, 10 minutes upon adjournment tonight. And if I could please meet with the House leadership, minority and majority, please, for just a couple minutes when we adjourn here today, I'd appreciate it. In my office. Any other announcements? Mr. Majority Whip, or Floor Leader, that's your name. That clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. General file is on your desk, and with that, I move we adjourn until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 20th, 2009.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. We are adjourned till 10 a.m. tomorrow.